Chapter 24. Perhaps it was in the exercise of his calling that he had come to see the troops depart. The porvenir of the day after next would no doubt relate the event, but its editor, leaning his side against the land, seemed to look at nothing. The front rank of the company of infantry drawn up three deep across the shore end of the jetty, when pressed too close would bring their bayonets to the charge ferociously, with an awful rattle, and then the crowd of spectators swayed back bodily, even under the noses of the big white mules. Notwithstanding the great multitude, there was only a low, muttering noise. The dust hung in a brown haze, in which the horsemen, wedged in the throng here and there, towered from the hips upwards, gazing all one way over the heads. Almost every one of them had mounted a friend, who steadied himself with both hands grasping his shoulders from behind, and the rims of their hats touching, made like one disc sustaining the cones of two pointed crowns with a double face underneath. A horse mozo would bawl out something to an acquaintance in the ranks, or a woman would shriek suddenly the word adios, followed by the Christian name of a man. General Berrios, in a shabby blue tunic and white peg-top trousers falling upon strange red boots, kept his head uncovered and stooped slightly, propping himself up with a thick stick. No. He had earned enough military glory to satiate any man, he insisted to Mrs. Gould, trying at the same time to put an air of gallantry into his attitude. A few jetty hairs hung sparsely from his upper lip. He had a salient nose, a thin, long jaw, and a black silk patch over one eye. His other eye, small and deep-set, twinkled erratically in all directions, aimlessly affable. The few European spectators, all men, who had naturally drifted into the neighborhood of the Gould carriage, betrayed by the solemnity of their faces their impression that the general must have had too much punch, Swedish punch, imported in bottles by Anzani at the Amarillo Club, before he had started with his staff on a furious ride to the harbor. But Mrs. Gould bent forward, self-possessed, and declared her conviction that still more glory awaited the general in the near future. Sonora, he remonstrated, with great feeling, in the name of God, reflect. How can there be any glory for a man like me in overcoming that bald-headed embustero with the dyed mustaches? Pablo Ignacio Berrios, son of a village alcalde, general of division, commanding in chief the Occidental Military District, did not frequent the higher society of the town. He preferred the unceremonious gatherings of men, where he could tell jaguar hunt stories, boast of his powers with the lasso, with which he could perform extremely difficult feats of the sort a married man should attempt, as the saying goes amongst the Llaneros, relate tales of extraordinary night rides, encounters with wild bulls, struggles with crocodiles, adventures in the great forests, crossings of swollen rivers. And it was not mere boastfulness that prompted the general's reminiscences, but a genuine love of that wild life which he had led in his young days, before he turned his back forever on the thatched roof of the parental Tolderia in the woods. Wandering away as far as Mexico, he had fought against the French by the side, as he said, of Juarez, and was the only military man of Costaguana who had ever encountered European troops in the field. That fact shed a great luster upon his name till it became eclipsed by the rising star of Montero. All his life he had been an inveterate gambler. He alluded himself quite openly to the current story how once, during some campaign when in command of a brigade, he had gambled away his horses, pistols, and accoutrements, to the very epaulettes, playing Monte with his colonels the night before the battle. Finally, he had sent under escort his sword, a presentation sword, with a gold hilt, to the town in the rear of his position, to be immediately pledged for 500 pesetas with a sleepy and frightened shopkeeper. By daybreak he had lost the last of that money too, when his only remark, as he rose calmly, was, "Now let us go and fight to the death." From that time he had become aware that a general could lead his troops into battle very well with a simple stick in his hand. It has been my custom ever since, he would say. He was always overwhelmed with debts. Even during the periods of splendor in his varied fortunes of a Costaguana general, when he held high military commands, his gold-laced uniforms were almost always in pawn with some tradesman. And at last, to avoid the incessant difficulties of costume caused by the anxious lenders, he had assumed a disdain of military trappings, an eccentric fashion of shabby old tunics, which had become like a second nature. But the faction Barrios joined needed to fear no political betrayal. He was too much of a real soldier for the ignoble traffic of buying and selling victories. A member of the foreign diplomatic body in Sta. Marta had once passed a judgment upon him. Colon Barrios is a man of perfect honesty, and even of some talent for war, mais il manque de tenue. After the triumph of the Ribierists, he had obtained the reputedly lucrative Occidental command, mainly through the exertions of his creditors, the Sta. Marta shopkeepers, all great politicians, who moved heaven and earth in his interest publicly, and privately besieged Senor Moraga, the influential agent of the Santome mine, with the exaggerated lamentations that if the general were passed over, we shall all be ruined. An incidental but favorable mention of his name in Mr. Gould Sr.'s long correspondence with his son had something to do with his appointment to, but most of all undoubtedly his established political honesty. No one questioned the personal bravery of the Tiger Killer, as the populace called him. He was, however, said to be unlucky in the field, but this was to be the beginning of an era of peace. The soldiers liked him for his humane temper, which was like a strange and precious flower unexpectedly blooming on the hotbed of corrupt revolutions. And when he rode slowly through the streets during some military display, the contemptuous good humor of his solitary eye roaming over the crowds extorted the acclamations of the populace. The women of that class especially seemed positively fascinated by the long drooping nose, the peaked chin, the heavy lower lip, the black silk eye patch and band slanting rakishly over the forehead. His high rank always procured an audience of caballeros for his sporting stories, which he detailed very well with a simple, grave enjoyment. As to the society of ladies, it was irksome by the restraints it imposed without any equivalent, as far as he could see. He had not, perhaps, spoken three times on the whole to Mrs. Gould since he had taken up his high command, but he had observed her frequently riding with the senior administrator, and had pronounced that there was more sense in her little bridle hand than in all the female heads in Sulaco. His impulse had been to be very civil on parting to a woman who did not wobble in the saddle, and happened to be the wife of a personality very important to a man always short of money. He even pushed his attention so far as to desire the aide-de-camp at his side, a thick-set, short captain with a Tartar physiognomy, to bring along a corporal with a file of men in front of the carriage, lest the crowd in its backward surges should gomote the mules of the Sonora. Then, turning to the small knot of silent Europeans looking on with an earshot, he raised his voice protectingly, "Sinners, have no apprehension. Go on quietly making your faro carol, your railways, your telegraphs. Here there's enough wealth in Costaguana to pay for everything or else you would not be here. Ha! Ha! Don't mind this little picardia of my friend Montero. In a little while you shall behold his dyed mustaches through the bars of a strong wooden cage. Sigh, sinners. Fear nothing, develop the country, work, work." The little group of engineers received this exhortation without a word, and after waving his hand at them loftily, he addressed himself again to Mrs. Gould. "That is what Don Jose says we must do. Be enterprising. Work. Grow rich. To put Montero in a cage is my work, and when that insignificant piece of business is done, then, as Don Jose wishes us, we shall grow rich, one and all, like so many Englishmen. Because it is money that saves a country, and, but a young officer in a very new uniform, hurrying up from the direction of the jetty, interrupted his interpretation of Senor Avellano's ideals. The general made a movement of impatience. The other went on talking to him insistently, with an air of respect. The horses of the staff had been embarked. The steamer's gig was awaiting the general at the boat steps. And Berrios, after a fierce stare of his one eye, began to take leave. Don Jose roused himself for an appropriate phrase pronounced mechanically. The terrible strain of hope and fear was telling on him, and he seemed to husband the last sparks of his fire for those oratorical efforts, of which even the distant Europe was to hear. Antonia, her red lips firmly closed, averted her head behind the raised fan. And young Deckard, though he felt the girl's eyes upon him, gazed away persistently, hooked on his elbow, with a scornful and complete detachment. Mrs. Gould heroically concealed her dismay at the appearance of men and events so remote from her racial conventions, dismay too deep to be uttered in words even to her husband. She understood his voiceless reserve better now. Their confidential intercourse fell, not in moments of privacy, but precisely in public, when the quick meeting of their glances would comment upon some fresh turn of events. As he had gone to his school of uncompromising silence, the only one possible, since so much that seemed shocking, weird, and grotesque in the working out of their purposes, had to be accepted as normal in this country. Decidedly, the stately Antonia looked more mature and infinitely calm, but she would never have known how to reconcile the sudden sinkings of her heart with an amiable mobility of expression. Mrs. Gould smiled a goodbye at Berrios, nodded round to the Europeans who raised their hats simultaneously, with an engaging invitation, "I hope to see you all presently, at home," then said nervously to Deckard, "Get in, Don Martin," and heard him mutter to himself in French, as he opened the carriage door, "La sorte en est jete." She heard him with a sort of exasperation. Nobody ought to have known better than himself that the first cast of dice had been already thrown long ago in a most desperate game. Distant acclamations, words of command yelled out, and a roll of drums on the jetty greeted the departing general. Something like a slight faintness came over her, and she looked blankly at Antonia's still face, wondering what would happen to Charlie if that absurd man failed. "La Casa, Ignacia," she cried at the motionless broad back of the coachman, who gathered the reins without haste, mumbling to himself under his breath, "Sai, La Casa. Sai, Si Nina." The carriage rolled noiselessly on the soft track, the shadows fell long on the moldy little plain interspersed with dark bushes, mounds of turned-up earth, low wooden buildings with iron roofs of the railway company. The sparse row of telegraph poles strode obliquely clear of the town, bearing a single, almost invisible wire far into the great campo like a slender, vibrating feeler of that progress waiting outside for a moment of peace, to enter and twine itself about the weary heart of the land. The café window of the Albergo de Delia Una was full of sunburned, whiskered faces of railway men. But at the other end of the house, the end of the Signora Inglesi, old Giorgio, at the door with one of his girls on each side, bared his bushy head, as white as the snows of Higuerota. Mrs. Gould stopped the carriage. She seldom failed to speak to her protégé. Moreover, the excitement, the heat, and the dust had made her thirsty. She asked for a glass of water. Giorgio sent the children indoors for it, and approached with pleasure expressed in his whole rugged countenance. It was not often that he had occasion to see his benefactress, who was also an Englishwoman, another title to his regard. He offered some excuses for his wife. It was a bad day with her. Her oppressions, he tapped his own broad chest. She could not move from her chair that day. Deckard, ensconced in the corner of his seat, observed gloomily Mrs. Gould's old revolutionist, then, offhand, "Well, and what do you think of it all, Garibaldino?" Old Giorgio, looking at him with some curiosity, said civilly that the troops had marched very well. One-eyed Berrios and his officers had done wonders with the recruits in a short time. Those Indios, only caught the other day had gone swinging past a double quick time, like Bersaglieri. They looked well fed too, and had whole uniforms. New uniforms, he repeated with a half smile of pity. A look of grim retrospect stole over his piercing, steady eyes. It had been otherwise in his time, when men fought against tyranny, in the forests of Brazil, or on the plains of Uruguay, starving on half-raw beef without salt, half-naked, with often only a knife tied to a stick for a weapon. And yet we used to prevail against the oppressor, he concluded, proudly. His animation fell, the slight gesture of his hand expressed discouragement, but he added that he had asked one of the sergeants to show him the new rifle. There was no such weapon in his fighting days, and if Barrios could not, yes, yes, broke in Don Jose, almost trembling with eagerness. We are safe. The good Senor Viola is a man of experience. Extremely deadly, is it not so? You have accomplished your mission admirably, my dear Martin. Deckard, lolling back moodily, contemplated old Viola. Ah, yes. A man of experience. But who are you for, really, in your heart? Mrs. Gould leaned over to the children. Linda had brought out a glass of water on a tray, with extreme care. Giselle presented her with a bunch of flowers gathered hastily. For the people, declared old Viola, sternly. We are all for the people in the end. Yes, muttered old Viola, savagely. And meantime they fight for you. Blind. Esclavos. At that moment young Scarf of the railway staff emerged from the door of the part reserved for the Signor Inglesi. He had come down to headquarters from somewhere up the line on a light engine, and had had just time to get a bath and change his clothes. He was a nice boy, and Mrs. Gould welcomed him. It's a delightful surprise to see you, Mrs. Gould. I've just come down. Usual luck. Missed everything, of course. This show is just over, and I hear there has been a great dance at Don Juice Lopez's last night. Is it true? The young patricians, Deckard began suddenly in his precise English, have indeed been dancing, before they started off to the war with the great Pompey. Young Scarf stared, astounded. Why, you haven't met before, Mrs. Gould intervened. Mr. Deckard, Mr. Scarf. Ah. But we are not going to Pharsalia, protested Don Jose, with nervous haste, also in English. Who should not jest like this, Martin? Antonia's breast rose, and fell with a deeper breath. The young engineer was utterly in the dark. Gee, great what? He muttered, vaguely. Luckily, Montero is not a Caesar, Deckard continued. Ought the two Monteros put together would make a decent parody of a Caesar. He crossed his arms on his breast, looking at Senor Avellanos, who had returned to his immobility. It is only you, Don Jose, who are a genuine old Roman Verominus, eloquent and inflexible. Since he had heard the name of Montero pronounced, young Scarf had been eager to express his simple feelings. In a loud and youthful tone he hoped that this Montero was going to be licked once for all and done with. There was no saying what would happen. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.